Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. The travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, King.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey, and please, would you have Mike raise his head off the desk? I mean, he's astounded by one of the news stories we're going to talk about tonight. I won't mention it right now, but Mike, I'm not kidding. It's the truth. Thank you much, Audrey, for getting us started again, and ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Jumble Justice Radio Show, and you're on the Blog Talk Radio Network listening, and we think you'll appreciate that. The Blog Talk Radio Network is a fascinating medium. And I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Johnny Cash for taking us on that trip across 90 cities and states. And we want to always encourage him nowadays, since Dayton has announced it. You can homestead in Dayton, Ohio, Johnny, and we stop about Dayton. So get off that truck and get in there and get you some land. If you stay on there for 5 years, I think it's yours. I don't know much about homesteading, but I believe that's the case. Emily and Mike, thank you very much for joining us also. And we look forward to working with you tonight on the show. Our show is what it always is, at least we try to make it that. We try to discuss issues, events, current news, and some developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. Our topic tonight is going to be sort of interesting. You'll hear a lot more about it. It's about jailhouse lawyers. What the heck is a jailhouse lawyer? If you work outside of criminal justice, you probably don't know. But that's a lawyer that ain't a lawyer inside the jail. It's a prisoner who 99.9% of the time does not have a law degree, but they act as lawyers and assist people in various things inside the prison. And a book of that same title, we'll be listening to the author preview that tonight. The author is certainly of national fame. He's on death row, been there about 23 years, and he's charged and convicted with killing a police officer. But anyway, we dedicate this show to our police officers and our court officials and corrections and juvenile justice and some of those private corrections officials that private security we don't think about much, but they provide a lot more protection too. There are now more private security officers in the United States than there are police officers. Most people don't probably realize that. You're listening on Blog Talk Radio, as I mentioned. It's a leading edge technology. What is possible if you would like to do it yourself? Is you can have a show, any interest group can have a show, any organization can have a radio show, and they can broadcast live and streaming audio over the internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners, and you can go numerous hours a week, and it's absolutely free on Blog Talk Radio. You can upgrade to a feature type of a program that gives you more advertising, and I think you can share revenue off of people that click on your site, etc. So you're allowed to do that also. The shows are archived almost immediately, and you can download them and use them for replay. If you want to scare off burglars coming into your house or something, you can play it. Sometimes people we understand around various parts of the country use at least segments of the show in their criminal justice classes. So get your own show if you don't like this one. There are plenty of things out there. As I mentioned tonight, the show is going to be about jailhouse lawyers, and Mumia Abu-Jamal is the gentleman that's going to be talking about his book From Inside a Prison Cell. He won't be the only person on the show tonight. Professor Cornell West and Professor Patricia Fernandez Kelly will also be talking, and I'll try to contain myself with some of these folks in the conversation. I respect both of them, but I think they're on the opposite end of the political spectrum. Would you say that, Audrey? I think they are, from our staff at least. But anyway, I think you'll find it interesting, and we won't be able to hear the whole thing, of course. We're going to, beach off of Book TV again, and you can go buy the book or listen to the whole book presented on booktv.org. What you can do as a listener, if you want, during the news segment of the show, I'll try to contain myself tonight on some of these news stories, you can call in. You can call in on the number 347-996-5983. That's 347-996-5983. And should it ever happen, you can hold five calls at a time, and we can all talk to each other. So that would be interesting. Audrey's a member of December. What Audrey is doing is getting out some of her favorite blonde jokes. She's always hesitant about this one, but Audrey, it's a joke. Come on, it's not going to bother anybody. So, Audrey, why don't you go ahead, and I should point out to our listeners while you're keying up for this that Audrey is a blonde. She was born in London, England, and she is a collector of blonde jokes and has more blonde jokes probably than any other person in the world. We're probably ready for an Audrey blonde joke reality show on television. What do you think, Audrey? Could be. Okay, let's hear your joke.
Professor Haley, the blonde joke for tonight is a change-up from our usual type of blonde story. I am sure you and our listeners will enjoy it. Here it is. A blonde guy and a brunette were happily married and about to have a baby. One day, the wife started having contractions, so the husband rushed her to the hospital. He held her hand as she went through a trying birth. In the end, there were two little baby boys. The blonde guy turned to his wife and angrily said, "All right, who's the other father?"
All right, who's the other father? But the Ohio Coalition Against Carrying Firearms in the State of Ohio has a real good message out, and some of the prisoners that are in prison tonight with our book presenter could probably pay attention to this, or should have in the past. The Ohio Coalition does not want us criminals to be carrying firearms. I believe that's who this message is directed toward. We play it every week in the interest of reducing crime, and we hope and pray that the criminals will hear this message, lay down their weapons, or turn them into the police department, and give up their life of crime. Go ahead, Ohio Coalition.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. Message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Ohio Coalition. And again, we do hope that this message falls upon the proper ears. Well, tonight we have a green tip, as usual, and this one is just critically important because I've noticed it today. I noticed it yesterday. The weather here in Ohio has been rather cold. It's been in the 20s during the daytime and a little bit under 20 at nighttime, and I have seen this waste of fuel and consumption. And let me read you the tip. This is right out of Esma Floyd's 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. I almost feel like going over and telling people, would you stop running your automobile? And here's our tip. This is tip 196, and it's entitled, Turn It Off. To save electricity, always turn off the lights when you leave the room, no matter how long you're leaving. The second tip has to do with this. You see people dropping people out off at schools. You see people waiting out in the parking lots for someone else in their family who's in a drugstore or a grocery store shopping, and they're running their motors. They are burning up fuel. They are contributed to global warming, and I think we need to maybe perhaps pass a law or an ordinance that says if you're not moving your car and transporting yourself somewhere, then maybe you shouldn't be allowed to run that motor. But just think of that, the engines that are idling at this very moment all over the United States, at the fuel we could be saving if people would pay attention to that. So turn it off when you have opportunity and chance to do that. And so you'll be a little bit cold, you know, if you're in a colder part of the United States, you know, it'll only be 5 degrees or 3 below 0 or something for a little while. And then you get in the car and you run that heater and you're off again. So that's our green tip for tonight. Well, let's take a look at some of this criminal justice thing. It is really good this week. I don't know if you saw this one. I think on a couple of television shows, well, maybe not TV shows, radio shows, I heard a couple people talking about this. Can you remember Charlie Manson? I think most people can. Well, guess what? Charlie was caught with a cell phone. Isn't that incredible? In prison. He's doing life in prison, of course. And I don't think he's doing. Yeah, I guess he is doing life. If I can get my news segment to change your thinking. Yes, there it is. Yes, Charlie Manson was caught with a cell phone. He's a murderous cult leader. He didn't kill anybody themselves, but he got other people to do it. But he was one of thousands of California inmates busted with a cell phone last year. Can you believe that? He used this to call unidentified people in California. He called New Jersey. He called Florida. He called British Columbia. This is according to the LA Times. One of the guys in the prison system, boy, this says this is real troubling. He's from the California Department of Corrections, a spokesman. She says that it's really troubling that we found Charlie Manson on the cell phone. He's 76 years old now. And he used the phone to order up any crimes that they don't know. But cell phones are banned from federal prisons, but the rules are murkier in state institutions, especially in California, it says, where overcrowding makes it impractical to punish the phone possessors with more time. It does. Guards found 1,400 cell phones in prisons in 2007, according to the New York Times. Then the number jumped to 6,995 in 2009. This is the ones they found. Now it goes up to 8,675 this particular year. And all that happens in the California prisons is they simply get a reprimand and they have the phone confiscated. So state lawmaker says they ought to have stiffer penalties for something like that. But again, they're not exactly sure what to do. But can you believe that Charlie Manson and all these other inmates have cell phones and not allowed to have one? If you get caught with one, you're just told you're not allowed to have one. Then I guess if you get another one, you can use it till you're caught again. They'll tell you you're not allowed to have one. And it just goes on and on and on, but that's a hoot. This is one I thought was real interesting. Actually, I'd never heard of this directly before. I knew that defense lawyers do this kind of thing. But here is a murder defendant, and this guy is in Clearwater, Florida, and when John DiTullio goes on trial Monday, jurors will not see this insulting tattoo he has on his neck. On one side of his neck is always up the side of his face. He has a swastika, a symbol. On the other side, I guess it's too disgusting that the New York Times article wouldn't even mention what it was. But his lawyer says that this is distracting. This will keep his client from getting a fair shake in front of a jury. He says it's easier to give someone who looks like you a fair shake. So he has asked the court to do something about this, and of course he probably doesn't have a penny. But since he's had this arrest, he's got these tattoos, so now they have decided to contract with a cosmetologist for $125 a day. So every time Mr. DiTullio goes to court, he'll first see the cosmetologist in the morning, and he or she will go over his tattoos. It's a 5-step process, I think. The first stage is a reddish layer to obscure the greenish tinge of the ink. Then they lay on other layers, and finally, by the time he shows up in court, he has a neck that looks like just like everybody else. And he's saying that this is, his lawyer saying this is absolutely necessary for him to get a fair shake. Isn't that incredible? So probably somewhere along the line, there's probably a federal dollar or two in there with your help to pay for this one way or the other. But I never heard that criminal defendants can get a cosmetologist in court. That's kind of a new one for me. There's another companion article that I found about dressing your client for court. And they say that they, you know, they try to get this these defendants to look as nice as they can in court. I guess that's the right word, nice. In other words, don't look like a criminal, don't look like a punk, don't look like somebody who commits crimes, whatever that means. So what they're doing, they try to get them dressed right, etc. The National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, their past president, he recalled a client some years ago accused of beating someone severely. He says the guy had like Popeye-like muscles, you know, really strong-looking muscles. And he told him, you know, you really got to do something about that. So he bought him a long-sleeve white shirt. And then when he shows up in court, he'd cut the sleeves off. he wanted to show his muscles. There's guys in biker gangs with real long hair and beards and all that type of stuff, and they try to get them all cleaned up for court. One of these clients, one of the lawyers told his client, look, he said, you got to come to court in something. You got to, you know, those jeans, they're not getting it. You know, dress up a little bit. So he's hoping when the guy comes to court, he'll look a little bit better. He comes the next time, he's going on a pair of blue jeans. He said, didn't I tell you to get rid of the jeans? He said, yeah, but yeah, these are my dress blue jeans. Then here's the last story on this, where a guy is defending someone in a car theft case. The guy is really, he's got long hair, straggly beard, jack-o'-lantern type of teeth, and real craggy appearance. And looks like he's a long methamphetamine and alcohol abuser. And what he did with this guy, he says, for the court, the client wore blue jeans and a purple velour jacket. Said he just looked horrible. In his summation to the jury, the lawyer says, ladies and gentlemen, look at my client. And noted that no one would mistake him for Robert Redford. He says, but you don't convict someone just because he's ugly. And his client didn't get up and hurt him. Yeah, but he actually mentioned that in a court of law. I think that is just incredible. Well, this next one, hold on to your seat if you haven't heard this week. It's here now, and it's going to be expanding. Now, let me see if I can find this one. This is one of the best ones I've heard in a long time. Janet Napolitano, our director of Homeland Security, announced the expansion of their department's national If You See Something, Say Something campaign. It's a snitching campaign to hundreds of Walmart stores across the country. When you go to certain checkout lanes, at the end you'll see a video of Janet Napolitano stating that you should be alert when you're at Walmart looking at the shoppers. And she says, I applaud Walmart for joining us. Right now it's in 280-some stores, and 230 stores in the United States. It's going to be expanding to 588. So when you check out at Walmart, you're going to hear Janet Napolitano telling you to look for suspicious things inside Walmart, out in the parking lot, and call the Department of Homeland Security or Transportation or proper law enforcement authorities. And I imagine we're probably going to, hire another 75,000 to 100,000 federal employees to take the phone calls. But I was in a Walmart after I heard this, and, you know, I saw people in there. I only noticed the women, but there were a couple there with oversized purses. And you never know. I'm thinking about calling. I wrote down some descriptive information because they could have an AK-47 in there, a small atomic bomb, backpack atomic bomb. You never know what they would have in those purses at Walmart. So be careful at Walmart. Don't look suspicious. And if you see someone else is suspicious, if you see something, say something. This is a nationwide campaign where we're developing we're trying to get the public alert. And 27 states are joining in this, and it will be 588 Walmart stores when it's all done. So I guess another way of looking at it, if you're at Walmart, people may be taking a closer look at you. Don't you find that a little bit incredible? Well, if you think that one's something, how about this one? You know about the WikiLeaks, you know, 250,000+ documents released. Lots of them were secret documents, others were restricted, confidential, whatever. And Mr. Assange is in jail in England on a very confusing set of charges, and he's going to be extradited perhaps to Sweden. But anyway, one private first class apparently got all this hundreds of thousands of documents and released them. And a lot of them are publicly displayed now. You can read articles about them, the New York Times. But here's what the federal government just did. I love it. In a classic case of shutting the barn door after the courses left, the Obama administration and the Department of Defense has ordered the hundreds of thousands of federal employees and contractors not to view the secret cables and other classified documents published by WikiLeaks. In other words, it's a violation of federal regulations now, orders. If you go to these documents that have already been released to the public and you read them, does that sound real federal to you? I mean, this, I can't believe. In other words, they cannot look at a newspaper or at a website that puts these documents out now, although the rest of the world can see them. They're not permitted to do that because they work for the federal government. That is really something. In case you didn't know it, we're now getting a little more data on Gitmo, our little club down there in Guantanamo Bay for terrorists. We found out that 150 former Guantanamo terrorists are either confirmed or suspected of reengaging in terrorist or insurgent activities, according to the new intelligence assessment released by the Director of National Intelligence Office on Tuesday. In total, 598 of these detainees have been transferred out of U.S. custody at Guantanamo. One out of four, 25% of these former detainees is now engaged or confirmed or suspected of being a recidivist in terms of terrorism against the United States government and other places. Isn't that comforting to know? And, of course, our current administration has decided to give these people civilian trials with all the rights as opposed, well, not all of them, but some civilian trials. And I'm not in favor of that. I think the military tribunal should have superseded that, and we could skip a lot of problems in that regard. But Club Gitmo, again, every time I see people at Club Gitmo, they're laying in lawn chairs. They're not working. It doesn't seem like they're working. These are our dangerous terrorists down there. And a long time ago, I was in that area of the country as a member of the world, as a member of the armed forces. But isn't that a hoot? We turn them loose. We get out of the country to take them. And then one out of four of them come back and work against us, perhaps even kill U.S. and allied troops overseas somewhere and plot terrorist acts that may or may not occur here in the future. But anyway, that's the end of our news segment tonight. I think we're going to do now is switch right over. I'm going to play this introductory part of the Cornell West and the other professor in terms of introducing the book title and the author. And then later on in the segment, the author calls in from prison. And I think you'll find it interesting how often you get to hear somebody talk from prison anyway. And I'd be curious to see what you think of our show tonight in this particular presentation. Here we go. Hold on just a second.
Labyrinth Books in Princeton, New Jersey, hosts the Hour and a Half Talk. former Black Panther Party member and death row inmate Mumia Abu-Jamal discusses his book, Jailhouse Lawyer, about prisoners defending other prisoners in the U.S. court system. He's calling from prison and talks with Princeton professors Cornell West and Patricia Fernandez-Kelly. Labyrinth Books in Princeton, New Jersey, hosts the hour-and-a-half talk.
Tonight, we're speaking via telephone to journalist and writer Mumia Abu-Jamal, who has spent the last 28 years on Pennsylvania's death row. We are also joined by two distinguished scholars from Princeton University, Dr. Cornell West, author of many books, most recently the memoir, Brother West. We also have Dr. Patricia Fernandez-Kelly of the Princeton University Department of Sociology. Please welcome them. We'd like to give special thanks to City Lights Books, the independent press, who published Mumia Abu-Jamal's new book, Jailhouse Lawyers, and in particular to City Lights editor Greg Rosario. We have to get through prison walls and prison rules in order to speak with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and thanks to everyone for your vision of not only what is, but what might be possible. I'm Virginia Harrigan of Labyrinth Books, and we welcome all of you. Just a little word about logistics. We're going to open with Cornell West and Patricia Fernandez-Kelly, and we're just going to start talking with each other here. We hope within a few minutes we will have Mumia Abu-Jamal on the line to engage in conversation with our panelists. Our panelists have only 15 minutes for conversation. Should we be lucky enough to win a little bit more time, we'll invite members of the audience to ask questions as well. When you make a connection with somebody in prison, and especially a maximum security facility like FBI Green, you also become subject to its rules, and we will be treated to things like recordings periodically when Mumia is on the line. The call could be prevented or interrupted, so we have to improvise, and we're gonna do okay. We have a fact sheet on Mumia's legal case recently put together by Dr. Mark Taylor of the Princeton Theological Seminary and a founding member of Educators from the Mumia Abu-Jamal. It's very useful, informative sheet. And after the call comes, we can take questions. We're glad to have so many people in the room who have thought and written extensively about this case. So now, if I may turn to our panelists, we have time to begin our discussion before Mumia rings in. So let me just start with you, Dr. West. Mumia Abu-Jamal's case has exemplified and defined an era of American politics just as sharply as have past struggles such as Scottsboro, Sacklin, Vanzetti, or the Rosenberg. What is it about the life, work, and struggle of Mumia Abu-Jamal that's of such enduring concern?
Okay, no, I thought we were going to start with my dear sister, but I will definitely start. Let me first say I want to salute my dear brother Cliff and Sister Dorothea, who are the visionary founders and leaders of Labyrinth. Give them a hand, please. We are so glad. We're so glad that you. And I want to thank my dear sister Virginia for facilitating this gathering. Very much. Very much so. For me, I go all the way back to Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal, that he has been a freedom fighter going back to through his membership to the Black Panther Party. And when he, in fact, was incarcerated, I was thoroughly convinced that he was innocent, so I was concerned about him getting a fair trial. And then when it discovered that some of the witnesses had, in fact, put forward some mendacious formulations, I was even more determined that he have a fair trial. Because if someone, both a human being, as a democratic citizen, and as a Christian, I'm concerned about the preciousness and pricelessness of each and every person. And therefore, I want a fair criminal justice system, and that includes a fair trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal. In addition, he's one of the great jailhouse intellectuals. I've written this wonderful book, Jailhouse Lawyers. But he is one of the great jailhouse intellectuals. He's a prophetic voice, and he tries to tell the truth about America from the vantage point of the least of these. That goes both in the 25th chapter of Matthew, but also as an intellectual, he's concerned about the poor, he's concerned about working people. He's concerned about gay brothers and lesbian sisters. He's concerned about
hatred against Jews, hatred against Arabs, and most concerned about a critique of the corporate greed that has been pushing the Democratic Project nearly off the cliff in the last 25 or 30 years. And so you say, why, Brother Mumin Abu-Jamal? One is because he deserves a fair trial. I'm convinced he didn't do it. Two is because he's a prophetic voice. And three is because he forces us to come to terms with the depth of the crisis of the American empire, American civilization, and how do we try to somehow get some democratic accountability of the greed on Wall Street, the connection of greedy oligarchs to our often spineless politicians in the White House, the State House, and how do you create some awakening so that we can somehow shatter the sleepwalking among those lies so called every day?
But I certainly want to acknowledge my debt to the organizers of this event by the number of people in this room. You can see that it's not as boring as some people think to be living in Princeton. And it's true. Also, I want to add that I accepted this invitation. I'm very grateful to Dorothea and to Virginia. But what they don't know is that I mostly accepted this invitation because it gives me an opportunity to actually interact with Cornel West, who is so big and so busy that it's not sufficiently available. So here we are thrown together into this conversation. But in all seriousness, I think that one of the things that is wonderful about this gathering is that it allows us to consider people who are behind bars and to acknowledge them not only as part of our humanity, but also their membership in our common social body. The book that is being celebrated today, Jailhouse Lawyers, is a welcome addition to a growing literature that makes clear there is vibrant life behind bars, not only the chaos and violence exploited by programs that you may have seen on television like Lock Off, which I cannot stomach, but the invisible acts, the acts that we have deliberately as a society made invisible of intellectually able individuals who toil and struggle under difficult circumstances to prove they are human. And before we go on to the larger subject, and I realize that it's Mumin Abu-Jamal who is the subject of this conversation, but let me, as a social anthropologist, as a member of the Department of Sociology at Princeton, put this into some perspective. Some of my favorite people in the world are in this room right now, and so you already know that, but for those of you who perhaps imagine that this question about imprisonment is simply kind of a fussy subject of charity and connection, I would like to place incarceration in some kind of perspective. We have more than 200,000 individuals living behind bars, and that does not include, by the way, and I will not bring it up, undocumented aliens in detention centers. Most of those who are behind bars are men. We have about the largest incarcerated population in the world. And what really, really irks me, the reason that I think it is so important, is that the risk of imprisonment is not evenly distributed throughout the population. If you are African-American and male and young, you have about nine times more likely that you will end up behind bars. The same is true about large numbers of Latinos. And so these are also the folks who do not receive adequate education or investment on the part of the society when they are very young. And so the way I try to put it to my students is that you get punished at the beginning of your life, and then you get punished as you become an adult.
Because we know that
the likelihood of incarceration is much higher among young men who live in poor neighborhoods, who have low levels of education, and upon whom the society has not invested adequately.
And I believe that
is totally inconsistent with the ideals of democracy and the institutions that regulate this country. Now, Niabu Jamal is possibly, I agree, the most famous prisoner in the world. And we must be grateful to him because many prisoners cannot sustain the kinds of conditions that exist in American prisons. And yes, I know that there are prisons throughout the world that are probably worse, but for the kind of country that we are, for the traditions that we have, the conditions are horrible. I know because for several years I worked hand-in-hand with prisoners at the New Jersey State Prison, and I took many of my students to work with them on the publication of a prison magazine. Because, you know, as I used to say, my Princeton University students really do deserve to go to jail. And they often went to go to Vail. Now, unfortunately, I was banned from prison, which gives rise to all kinds of jokes in my circle, because you probably have never met someone who is not wanted even in prison. And especially, I regret that because I was uncharacteristically well-behaved. And despite that, as the authorities, with total impunity, decided that they did not want to continue educational programs on behalf of prisoners, I was collateral damage. It wasn't even really personal. So a lot of the people that I know behind bars are people who cannot have this kind of event. And so Niabu Jamal, who has this notoriety, who's famous, and who has the intelligence and the education to write the books that he writes, really becomes a very important representation of a dimension of prisons that most of the people in the United States are not acquainted with. And I believe that is a very important thing. Final comment. It surprises me because, you know, no matter how we cut it, Niabu Jamal, when he calls us here, which we hope he will be able to do, is pulling us from death row. That requires a lot of consideration because, as far as I'm concerned, it still surprises me that arguments continue to be ventilated in this country about the legitimacy of the death penalty in this civilized country. Only a few authoritarian regimes and the United States insist on destroying prisoners as a punitive measure for crime. And all this in the face of incontrovertible facts that make clear the death penalty is not only inhumane but ineffective. And I would like to just mention that, as you probably know, and this is an educated audience, more than 200 prisoners, and this is not a popular cause. So when you actually...
I do have to mention that no person who's been executed has ever come back and committed another murder. And some of them who are executed think they deserve it.
That's true. As a result of the application of new DNA-based technology, you have to wonder how many other people are in prison who should not be there. There is no compelling evidence that the death penalty curtails crime. And I repeat the point that is most...
She's wrong.
That is the uneven distribution of imprisonment, so that it's the weakest members of our society who are likely to end up in prison. Finally, I'm delighted to see that there are so many people in this room, because my impression is that the reason why the abuses continue, the reason why it's so easy to beat up on prisoners, no matter what their offenses are, is because of a large public indifference. Maybe Foucault is right, I think he is, that prisoners languish behind bars, not in order to combat crime, but in order that an indifferent public will imagine that it is superior by comparison to those who are behind bars. Those are just some general comments that I want to put on the table, because although I do want to recognize and acknowledge the value of the contribution of Abu Jamal, he is the star this evening, I also want all that he represents to be placed in the proper perspective.
Those numbers, that was 2.3 million
incarcerated.
Is that right? No, we want to be clear.
2.3
million folk, each one of them precious and priceless, even if many did make that judgment.
I was going to correct her.
Priceless and deserve for us to keep track of their humanity. Their humanity has been rendered invisible. The stereotypes, it's that awesome projected make it easy for too many of our fellow citizens to be indifferent to their situation, and yet their destiny is inextricably bound to our destiny. I know here at Princeton, we have magnificent students who go to Borders now. Blessed to go with you. A number of folks, we have alumni and others who go every month. I was just at Greaterford. We were just talking to Brother Mark Taylor. Mark Taylor here is the chairman of, give him a hand, Professor Mark Taylor, Prince Theological Seminary, educator from Mumia Abu-Jamal. He's been at it for 20 years now. But they're at Greaterford. They have a magnificent program of public safety initiative where you actually have lifers without parole along with others in the prison. When they are released, they go back into the community to fight crime. So though they may have engaged in criminal activity, when they go back, they become anti-criminal citizens. Why? Because, again, to try to get the public to see the prison-industrial complex has become an integral part of our society. More and more persons push, in fact, a new law.
And we have the lowest crime rates in a half century. That's been the last 3 years.
The largest. It's the quickest growing group. And this is also true for new immigrants. One more new immigrant. Even though, generally speaking, you know, it's black and brown. We're waiting for our brother. Oh, absolutely. We're waiting for our brother.
Well, you know, the other thing we could do is we could take a few questions from the audience. Does anybody have a question? You step right up to the microphone.
Hi. Not hesitant. Well, that's a serious. You got a question. Yeah, it's a blessing to see you. You all know she's a legend at this town. Yeah, she is a living legend.
You got a call
coming
in. Perfect.
What?
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hello,
Well, before I begin, let me just say I want to move, and I love all of you, and thank though it's a cold, somewhat snowy night. At least it is in Greene County, Pennsylvania. So I thank you all for coming. And welcome. This is from the press of Johann Floyd. I mean, come on. Seriously. What in the hell is a Johann Floyd? Depending on your station in life, the term is apt to evoke a variety of responses. Disbelief, laughter, for some, perhaps confusion. Jailhouse lawyer? The term implies a dissonance, a kind of contradiction in terms. Yet, even if some shun the title, there are tens of thousands of men and women who actually are such a thing. And like most people, they're heir to all the winds of whim, good and bad, competent and incompetent, large-hearted and petty. Years ago, before I entered the House of Death, I interviewed a man in Philadelphia's Holmesburg prison who was quite opinionated on the subject. His name was Delbert Affert, a well-known member of the Revolutionary Move organization, who soon would face a de facto life sentence in Pennsylvania's dungeon for being among nine people who had the temerity to survive the deadly police assault of their home and headquarters on August 8, 1970. Delbert Affert was an eloquent interviewee who spoke with a distinctive country accent, his conversation peppered with passion, reason, and commitment. He spoke disparagingly of jailhouse lawyers. So when I asked him why he felt this way, he responded, "Them dudes get in there, read all them law books, and, well, you know it, they'd be crazy as hell." "What do you mean, crazy?" I asked. "Well, they may not be crazy when they get here, but after a while, after a few months of reading that shit, they go down to City Hall, and when they see that some folks down there in City Hall, in the system, don't really go by that so-called law, well, it fucking drives them crazy." "Yeah, man, but why drive them dudes crazy?" "Because they can't believe that the system don't follow their own law." "But why?" I continue. "It drives their ass crazy because they can't handle the fact that the system just make and break laws as it sees fit. How many treaties they done signed with the Indians? Ain't a one of them they done kept. Some of them broke before the ink was dry on them old treaties. Them the same folks who run the system today. If they couldn't keep a treaty with Indians when they first got here, what make you think they're going to keep their so-called law today, especially when it comes to me and you, man? Bruh, I get that. I understand. But what's up with that crazy jailhouse lawyers? I don't get that. They go crazy because, Lou, they really believe in the system. And the system always betray those that believe in it. That's what drives them out of their minds, man. They can't handle that. It literally drives them out of their minds. I see them around here, walking around here today, crazy as a beer bus. It took me a while, but I got them. When he told me those words, I was a free man. As free as a black man can be in America. And working as a reporter and producer for Philadelphia Public Radio Station, when Delbert Affert broke it down for me, I had no idea that years later his words would take on such significance. Thank you for listening. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu Jamal.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah, right there, brother. That's powerful, don't they?
This call is from the Post Correctional Institution at Green, and the subject of monitoring and recording.
You still there, my brother?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. I tell you, brother, it's not just the powerful and poignant words, but it's also the style and the form, though, man. I hear a little Curtis Mayfield in your voice, you know what I mean? A rich, rich tradition that flows through you. And that connects to each and every one of us who are concerned about justice from below, which holds across the board, but begins we as poor folk catching hell in the language of Malcolm X. And I salute your witness. And the thing is that you are a free black man on death row.
Well, don't tell nobody.
No. We want you free on the outside, but you see, there's different kind of freedoms, you know what I mean? Believe me, we've got a whole lot of folks out here who are still in prison. And their minds and hearts and souls.
That's absolutely true.
Very
much. I'm reminded of, wasn't it Sojourner Truth who, no, I'm sorry, it was Harriet Tubman, when she was commended for freeing those hundreds of black folks there. Mm-hmm. She could have freed a whole lot more if they knew they were slaves.
That's exactly right. And she had to, she was only 4 feet and about 7 inches, and she had some 6'5" folks who got scared. She had to put the gun and say, Mama, going to shoot you dead if you make some noise. Because you're going to reveal all the rest of them involved. But that's the tradition out of which we come, my brother.
That is exactly
and
true.
It's got roots that's rooted in struggles against white supremacist slavery, which supports American terrorism. But those R-O-O-T-S have R-O-U-T-E-S routes that take us to every corner of the globe. That's why you represent a struggle for black freedom that's concerned about the freedom of everybody, but it looks at the world from below.
From an inspirational institution
that's
screening and the subject of monitoring
is recording. Well, brother, I certainly try because, you know, even though we all come from, you know, different environments and different backgrounds, this is one world.
That's right.
And so
one human family.
The same air.
Absolutely.
You know, we drink the same water. I mean, it used to be they have segregated water fountains, but they ain't got that no more.
Let me ask you a question, which is of some significance to me, because one of the things that I noticed about prisoners is that they are about the only population that we completely falsify and only recognize in terms of the crimes, alleged or real, that they have committed. We allow in our imagination other people to grow and change, to become different, to be redeemed, to grow. But with respect to those in prison, we always imagine them only in terms of what could be the worst possible act. And I am interested, because not everybody can do what you have done. I think what is extraordinary about you is that you have been able to give a face that is not only humane, but intellectually potent to a very large population. But I'm curious to know whether you would agree with that statement, and how do prisoners in your circle deal with that kind of essentialization? I'm sorry about the word, but you know what I'm saying?
I do, and I would just say this, if I may. Just yesterday, I spoke with a brother who was an anti-death penalty activist, but a global one. That is, he meets with people from around the world, that goes to conferences with people from around the world. And he told me something that was really quite remarkable that I had never heard of or read of. He was at a conference in California, and a scholar from Turkey was there. And the guy was telling me, you know, when we hear Turkey, we think of course, some of the infamous movie Midnight Express. Right? The Midnight Express was this movie, I think it starred Brad Davis, and it showed a very repressive and brutal system, prison system in Turkey. Well, the scholar explained to him that when a Turkish politician runs for office, what he promises to get elected is forgiveness and leniency and justice and fairness for people arrested and charged with offenses. And when he said this, my mouth dropped. I said, damn, it's like that in Turkey. He said, yes. And when I thought about it, it made a lot of sense, only because we know that Turkey is a non-Arab but a Muslim country. Many Muslim countries really do follow bits of the Quran, where there are provisions in the Quran for forgiveness for all kinds of, you know, offenses against communities and people. The only question, of course, in such an instance is, will the family forgive? The family forgives, and the state, you know, offers forgiveness as well. But to just imagine a politician running like that, it kind of blew my mind, because you can't think of something similar in the American context. It's the exact polar opposite. But it also shows us that what we think we know about another country is based on sometimes false projections over our people. We would never have thought of Turkey as that kind of country, but of course it is.
Very real. But I want to thank you first for your wonderful piece on science fiction on Octavia Butler and Du Bois' short story in Left Turn. You know,
Turkey does not operate under Islamic law. That's an exception. That nation is.
Oh, Lord, no, I tell you not, my brother. I think you wanted us to read Neil Ferguson's piece on complexity and collapse in foreign affairs, talking about empires that are in deep decline, culture in decay, greed running amok, poor people, working people, oftentimes feeling so impotent, powerless, hopeless, helpless, so that they don't organize or don't mobilize. Did you want to give us your characterization of where we are right now in light of Ferguson's talk about empire?
I read that 2 days ago.
Yeah, so it was on your mind, right? It was on mine too.
I was blown away by it because, I mean, of course, this is a scholar who can be deemed conservative. I mean, coming from Oxford and whatnot, and, you know, of course, British.
Yeah.
But when he looked at empires around the world, he found something very similar, a kind of a rise, a coasting, and then a decline. And, of course, there are different reasons for different eras. And I think, you know, most people understood that the empire was in decline, especially during the last administration, when things were so raw and so crude. You know, we don't torture, you know, that kind of stuff. Of course, you know, in the former administration, we had Abu Ghraib and we had Guantanamo and those kinds of things. The truth of the matter is we still have those kinds of things. We have Abu Ghraib in every state in the United States. We have Guantanamo in every state in the United States and in the federal system. And it's just that, you know, we talk about it in terms of an administration. We don't talk about it in terms of a system. And until we begin looking at the empire as being a bipartisan reality that affects people no matter who's at the top, it will never be able to change this reality that we're living in, the fact that we're all in a tiny system.
Well, I think you can see that the inmate, the convictee, he is interested in changing radically the United States government and certainly our prison system. I'm not sure what we're supposed to be doing with prisoners who murder, rape, rob, do it on multiple occasions, and recidivate. I'd be interested in what his answer is about that. I think I've heard it. But anyway, that's about what we can do tonight, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to hear the rest of that book. Go ahead and look at it on booktv.org, or, of course, you can buy it in bookstores or off the Internet. And it's called Jailhouse Lawyers, and the author is Mumia Abu-Jamal. And he's in prison now on death row, and his case still has not been resolved. Check with us. We'll see you next week, and we'll ask Vera Lynn to take us off.
I know we'll meet again some.